Hello everybody, this is Talking History. Today we have Dr. Frederica Teite of the Institute of Early American History and Culture at the College of William & Mary, now known as the Omohundro Institute. What is the Omohundro Institute? Would you explain that term, a very interesting term?
Yes, the Institute was founded in 1943 as a joint venture by Colonial Williamsburg and the College of William & Mary, with the hopes of encouraging interest in scholarship in early American field, which at that point, I guess during the war, partly for democracy's sake and partly because they felt it was languishing in general. So we've been around for more than 50 years. It has both a book publishing program and a William & Mary quarterly, a quarterly journal, and other programs as well. The main sources of funding have been from Colonial Williamsburg and the college, with an occasional, usually anonymous donor or beneficiary. But a few years ago, a man named M.H. Omohundro, who lived in Richmond and had been an undergraduate at William & Mary back in, I think, the 1930s, made the Institute the primary beneficiary of his will. He had made two fortunes, one on Wall Street in the 1920s, which he lost in the crash, and then returned to Richmond and rebuilt his fortune largely through real estate, and was a very astute financial manager. And we do not really know what the sum total of the estate will be, but it was sufficient in terms of the promise in his will to make the Institute the main beneficiary that the college and Colonial Williamsburg agreed to rename the Institute the Omohundro Institute in his honor because of the endowment that we hope to see in the future. His family goes way back in Virginia. You can find the Omohundros, but it's a little murky exactly what the actual origins of that name is. They like to claim that it's French Huguenot people who came in the 17th century, but that's not been verified. It's an interesting name, and there's been many descendants. There's a famous Omohundro who was in the Wild West show with Buffalo Bill, and there's a out in Colorado. There's a museum and a kind of historical society around him. But his name was Texas Jack Omohundro. But we don't really know the ethnic origins of the family name. But that's why we're named Omohundro Institute. We've had many people wonder what the name is. Some people think we've now named after a Japanese car company. Others people think it's an Indian name, but in fact it's named after Mr. Omohundro from Richmond, Virginia.
The nuts and bolts of it is the Institute of Early American History and Culture.
That's right.
Could you tell us what you actually do there? Please.
I'm in charge of the book publishing program. My official title is editor of publications, and this book program, as I said, it's the first book was published in 1947, so it's a program of long standing. I haven't been there that long, but the responsibilities that I have are both to acquire book manuscripts and to do substantive editing on those manuscripts. It's a very selective book program. We publish maybe 4 to 6 books a year at most. I have a PhD in history, and the editor of publications traditionally, who my predecessors also always had PhDs in early American history, with the idea that a practicing historian editor would be a person most able to give very substantive guidance to authors to revise their manuscripts and produce really outstanding books in the early American field. We've published over 140 books, 150 I think now, maybe even more. I haven't counted recently. Many of them are prize winners, and I think we like to say we go the extra mile, or I say I go the extra footnote with an author in terms of really working to help the author produce the best book that he or she can in terms of revisions, thinking of the implications of the work, and spending time to do, to really dig in and explore the topic in the way that the author would like to. I also have colleagues who are manuscript editors, and so when I'm finished doing the substantive editing and think the book's ready for to proceed into copy editing, that goes to one of our manuscript editors at the Institute. And here again, we do very detailed, careful copy editing in the book program that includes checking quotations and sources, citations for accuracy. The copy editors are all really skilled and wonderful colleagues, as my colleagues, copy editors, and they spend what probably most presses would consider an inordinate amount of time, sometimes up to 4 months or 5 months, copy editing a really long manuscript before we send it to the University of North Carolina Press, who publishes our books. And that means they take it through production and do the marketing and design and distribution, advertising, and exhibiting the books at conferences.
They take it for granted that you've done everything else before you send it to them. They have complete faith in your process.
They do. Whenever we have a book that's getting close to going into production, usually before it goes into copy editing, when the final manuscript comes into my office, I submit it to the press for them to give to their board of governors, and I do a complete editorial packet explaining the nature of the book and providing them with the reader's reports so that they do review the contents and our decision, but they've never overturned our decision to publish a book. They sometimes have questions about anything from whether a particular revision was done or length or the marketing of it, but normally their board of editors is reviews and approves what we've already decided, which is this is a really good book for the Institute to publish. So, but it's a collegial relationship in which we honor their process as well as our own in terms of submitting it to their board of governors. But they what we send to the press ultimately is are now computer discs with the books pretty much ready to go into composition and design and then to the printers. So they don't do any kind of second-guessing on our editing at the Institute.
The listeners also will realize that this is an enormously time-consuming work that Dr. Toity has to engage in. But the very striking aspect, I think, of her work as an historian is that she is also a very, very productive and original historian in her own right, in addition to midwiving other people's books, you might say. So maybe we can turn to your own research for a bit, Dr. Toity. Could you describe your major areas of interest?
My PhD dissertation was on frontier Kentucky and the aftermath of the Revolution. And when I did that, I was interested in understanding how the post-revolutionary settlement worked out for people who were not so privileged, people who did not necessarily have land. In an earlier part of my career where I'd worked on the papers of James Madison, I worked on the 1780s correspondence, and a lot of people from Virginia went to Kentucky in that period, and I became really intrigued with the contention and contest that was going on in the land beyond the Appalachian mountain chain. And a lot of it had to do with people wanting land, not getting it, overlapping land claims. And I was intrigued how that intersected with the kind of idea that in America land was free and everyone should be a landed proprietor and participate in the political system. So I delved into that and looked at tenantry and landlessness in Kentucky, exhausted myself in front of microfilm readers looking at tax records to kind of probe the areas of the American promise that weren't made good in the aftermath of the Revolution. After a long time, finished my dissertation, went on doing my historical editing career. While I worked on my dissertation, I needed to support myself, so I did some part-time research for someone. I was living in Washington, D.C. I was hired to go through different papers collections in the Library of Congress. This person was doing an edition of William Thornton, who was an early resident of Washington. there were various families that the Thorntons were close to who had left their papers. In fact, through the Thornton papers had come to the Library of Congress through this one family named the Smiths. And the wife, Margaret Baird Smith, had written voluminous letters to particularly two sisters of hers in New Jersey and New York. And my friend Charles Harris, who was the editor of the Thornton papers, designated this as one of the collections that he wanted me to take a look at, particularly because the two collections had come simultaneously to the Library of Congress. So I started in on this. There were volumes and volumes of these letters. I started in on these letters just looking for Thornton references, trying to get an idea of the social network and contacts that the Thorntons and the Smiths shared. And I became totally intrigued with this woman who was a marvelous writer, had tremendously descriptive anecdotes and powerful prose telling about early Washington society. This is the period from 1800 to the 1840s that she lived there. I started taking way too many notes for the purposes that I was hired, and nevertheless, I couldn't stop. And at one point, I even thought about giving up my own dissertation on Frontier Kentucky and turning my attention to Margaret Baird Smith. This was back in the late 1970s, and I stopped in at my the place where I was doing my PhD at Johns Hopkins University, and mentioned to one of the people I'd been doing work with that I was really intrigued with this woman in the early Republic. And he just looked at me, arched his eyebrows, and said, "Well, if you want to be known as a woman's historian, I guess you could change your topic." So I quickly backpedaled, thinking, no, I don't want to be known as just a woman's historian, and pursued my topic in Frontier Kentucky, which I am glad I did. But I stored these notes in memory of Margaret Baird Smith and carried them from place to place with me, and much later went back to them and had an opportunity through a research fellowship to take some time and think about what I had gathered, what I had read, and to do more research. And this led me into, for that fellowship at the Bunning Institute, I had to give a public lecture. And so for the first time, actually second time, sat down and tried to write out some ideas about the significance of this woman and her life in early Washington society. And that is how I got interested in her, and how I've continued gradually writing papers and inching my way towards doing a book on Margaret Baird Smith and the political culture of the early Republic. The reason I told you about Kentucky in relation to Margaret Baird Smith, it was when I had a research leave in the earlier 1990s to work on Margaret Baird Smith that it finally dawned on me that there really was a connection in my historical perspective between Kentucky and Margaret Baird Smith. And the connection is that both of those subjects allowed me to kind of stand outside of the core political developments in the new nation and look at people who felt marginalized by that political settlement of landed republicanism, to look at its limitations. And that oddly enough, standing in Frontier Kentucky and looking at it from a landless person's perspective, or standing in the center in Washington, D.C. and looking at it from, albeit an elite woman's perspective, but a woman who felt herself very much restricted and closed off from what she loved most, which was politics and power, that both of those gave me vantage points to see what the limitations in terms of the new nation and its promise to be all things to all men were. For me, it was a very interesting, for a while when I was working on those two different topics, felt kind of crazy that they seemed so dissimilar to me, but ultimately I found I had my own logic for pursuing both of the topics.
Do you think there might be some relationship between their perspective and your perspective? But I'm wondering, do you think they're put you in a similar position to your subjects?
I hadn't ever thought of it that way, and that is an interesting, a kind of self-inflicted marginalization in a way. And I think that's true. I think there's another way in which working that particular kind of vein of history of looking askance or trying to find a critical position to assess the construction of power, which is what I'm really interested in a way, that's what history really is for me, that history is a constant exercise in detaching you from your own blinders and investment in prerogatives and the status quo or whatever, and critically thinking about yourself and your position in society and trying to get out of yourself and understanding the perspective of other people. And so I think that I'm by character drawn to topics that allow me to try to do the same thing in the past, which is to kind of critique the center from the edges. At the same time, I've also kind of thought that for me, writing is a struggle, and there's a way in which I feel to be a kind of inarticulate historian, and I do live that out by being an editor rather than a practicing academic who's teaching and writing full time. So to that extent, that for me, that's maybe more of the connection, is that I'm struggling to get out my own voice, just the way, in fact, Margaret Beard Smith felt herself in many ways not to be heard in her own life and her many discontents with her situation as a wife and a mother, that she in a way silenced herself often in terms of her own discontents, forcing herself to do her duty and be the virtuous woman that was held up as a model in her life, in her period. So I think that on that kind of voiceless element, I do identify with the kinds of topics that I've chosen.
Do you think your higher education, anyway, has this sort of distinguished record? I mean, you're at Radcliffe and you graduated cum laude, and then you went to William & Mary for the MA, and finally Johns Hopkins, which is, you know, this famous graduate school for historians and so forth. Do you think, and you mentioned that your dissertation advisor sort of was slightly contemptuous of your addressing.
Well, it was not my advisor.
Sorry.
Oh. Another one of the professors that I worked with, yeah. A man, I would add.
do you think those institutions helped you or hindered you actually becoming an historian in the long run?
I think ultimately each one of them helped me. I have very mixed feelings about my undergraduate institution, but the one thing that I truly loved the last couple years was the privilege of going into Widener Library, into the stacks, and roaming at will in that fabulous library and reading. Then I was doing English history, reading the books and doing papers, and that truly spurred my love of history. I went to college thinking I was going to be a veterinarian, came out of it a historian, or a wannabe historian anyhow. And it was, I think, that experience of the vast shelves of historical knowledge at my disposal that made me focus on my love of the research, reading and thinking and part of history. I didn't really have any desire to be a teacher then or since, and I couldn't figure out what you could do other than be a professor if you wanted to pursue history. And a very wonderful person at the Radcliffe Career Office told me about something called documentary editing, historical documentary editing, and shoved me down to the Adams Papers project at the Massachusetts Historical Society. They were looking for an editorial assistant. In the end, I didn't get that or take that job, really, but it did open that world to me and led me to William & Mary in terms of its editing apprenticeship program along with the MA. And so when I was there, I got to be an editorial assistant on the papers of John Marshall, and that really led me off into the career of historical editing that I've pursued ever since. So I think that all of the institutions, you know, in their own what they offered and what I kind of figured out for myself proved to be the right choices for me. When I went back to graduate school later in my 20s, Johns Hopkins probably was the perfect place for me because it operates on a seminar system, and I had been doing history as a historical editor, so I was halfway there, and I think it would have been very irksome for me to have to take classes with lectures, and I was really free to create my own graduate program at Johns Hopkins, and their seminar system still, I think, is superb for the right kind of person who maybe has a little more maturity than some people do when they come right out of undergraduate school. But for me, it was a really perfect place to be.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It's really crucial that any graduate program have that kind of openness mm-hmm. in it, you know. I noticed that your next book is going to be, it's forthcoming. It's a joint work with Joyce Appleby, mm-hmm. of whom, again, I hope historians listening know who she is, or the general audience. She's the recent head of the AHA, very distinguished historian in your period at UCLA. Could you describe that project?
This is a new edition of a book called First 40 Years of Washington Society, which is it came out in the early 20th century, edited by a man named Gayard Hunt, and it was a selection of Margaret Baird Smith's letters from this collection that's in the Library of Congress. It's a very, very small percentage of the letters. Was reprinted once in the 1960s. The book is out of print now. And Emmy Sharp, the kind of a college textbook publisher, approached Joyce Appleby a number of years ago, asking her to suggest some people's memoirs from the early Republic. That was when she was working on the book that has since come out, and of her own, that looks at the new generation of Americans after the Revolution. And Joyce and I had been at the same time at American Antiquarian Society doing research on our respective projects. I was working on Margaret Baird Smith, Margaret Baird Smith's First 40 Years of Washington Society was one of the books she suggested to Sharp, and that's the one they chose, and she very generously invited me to co-edit it with her. That was a number of years ago. I am ashamed to say that I've been the laggard on this, and it has a lot to do with my being a documentary editor. When I was hired to go through the Smith papers in the Library of Congress, I came to realize how faulty the First 40 Years of Washington Society is in terms of letters that are spliced together to two different correspondents, sometimes 10 years apart. I took a fair number of notes, but I've been working very hard to try to sort out the mishmash that's in First 40 Years of Washington Society. Have hired some graduate students to proofread the transcriptions, and I'm actually adding some material to this new edition that's not in First 40 Years of Washington Society to make it a more representative collection of Margaret Baird Smith's letters and a more accurate one that, given everything else I'm doing, has taken me more time than I'd like to admit. I actually need to take time off and go up to the Library of Congress and check some of the last things that I haven't been able to find on the microfilm version of these letters. So it's been forthcoming for a while. Joyce, if you're listening, I'm sorry. I think it will be, when we get it out, a much more interesting collection, because the First 40 Years of Washington Society is almost wholly a selection of what I would call Margaret Baird Smith's kind of social public face in Washington, where she writes about the political personages that visit their home and she observes in Congress. And she comes across as something of a kind of a socialite, very gregarious, happy woman observer of the political and social scene in Washington. And that certainly was part of her story. But it was the realization that there was this whole other side of her when I went through her complete correspondence that made me want to work on her. And it's a side that reveals a woman quite angry, discontented with being a woman, rebelling against being confined to the domestic sphere, with tremendous intellectual ambitions of her own that she finally realized in terms of starting a career as a published writer in the 1820s and 1830s, that made me think this is a really fabulous person to view the spectrum of limitations and opportunities that the new nation offered for, albeit elite, but women who were, and others who were excluded from the political center of the nation. So I've been trying to insert some of her diary and letter entries that reveal this other side of her, in terms of both her discontents and her aspirations for herself, to make it a book for the 21st century instead of the 20th.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Tata.
Thank you.